Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. The devastation of Pearl Harbor and the American victory at Midway were prelude to a greater challenge, rolling back the vast Japanese Pacific Empire, island by island. Ian Toll's new book, The Conquering Tide, encompasses the heart of the Pacific War, the period between mid-1942 and mid-1944, when parallel Allied counteroffensives north and south of the equator washed over Japan's far-flung island empire like a conquering tide. It was the largest, bloodiest, most costly, and most technically innovative and logistically complicated amphibious war in history, and it fostered bitter inter-service rivalries, leaving wounds that even victory would not heal. The volume is the second of Ian Toll's Pacific War trilogy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome historian Ian Toll to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thanks for having me.
Of course, this is volume two of the Pacific War trilogy. When you wrote the first book, how soon into that did you know it was going to be a trilogy, or was that always the plan?
You know, actually, the plan was to, strange as it seems in retrospect, write a one-volume history of the Pacific War, and that was originally the contract that I entered into with W.W. Norton. And I had about 800 pages written, and I was at the Battle of Midway, which is 6 months into a war that lasted almost 4 years. So I called my editor and I said, we've got a problem. I can give you a 3,000-page book if you want. And he said, no, let's make it a trilogy. So that's what we did.
And what does that speak to about what you're able to say on the subject? And quite frankly, what is there to say?
Well, it's it's the largest naval war ever fought, probably, and we can hope, largest naval war that will ever be fought. Only war that has ever been fought across the length and breadth of the Pacific, an ocean so large that you could fit all of the world's land masses into it with room to spare. There's obviously a very large literature on this war, as there is in every aspect of the Second World War, but it has become, over the years, very piecemeal, very rich but very disjointed, and we've had a lack of narratives that tell the entire story of this conflict, and so that's what I've set out to do. And it feels like a three-volume history is about the right length to touch on every aspect of the conflict, to do it in a way that really aspires to the storytelling virtues of traditional history. And so this is the second volume, as you say. It's the heart of the war. It's the Allied counteroffensive, which began at Guadalcanal and ended in mid-1944 with the conquest of the Marianas Islands and the irreversible strategic defeat of the Japanese Navy.
So bring us to the baseline of what we should know going into this book of what has happened and where we are historically.
Well, the war began, as you know, with the surprise strike on Pearl Harbor, which was a deeply shocking event for the American people, also for our military leadership. A country which we had insisted, our experts had insisted on holding somewhat in contempt, particularly with regard to their air power, had managed in about 15 minutes to knock all of our Pacific Fleet battleships out of action, losing only less than 30 planes in the process. And so the war began with a tremendous crisis, and our leaders were able to mobilize what was left of the Pacific Fleet, and with some extraordinary contributions by our codebreakers, were able to anticipate a major Japanese move against Midway Atoll almost exactly 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and deliver a devastating counterpunch at the Battle of Midway, in which the Japanese lost four of their first-line aircraft carriers with all of their airplanes. So this book picks up right in the aftermath of that American victory at the Battle of Midway.
And we see American forces trying to free these countless Pacific islands from the grasp of the Japanese. Did they know what they were up against in just sheer number?
Well, yeah, I think that there was, by the middle part of the war, I think the Allies knew what they had to do. The scale of what they had to do was tremendously imposing and intimidating. But they did basically have a blueprint for how to defeat Japan. And it would require amphibious operations, which are unique in the sense that they require the different services to work together very closely, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force. And one of the themes that I've used to unify this narrative is how inherently the different services, and it's still true today, have very intense rivalries, really, and strong institutional identities which come into conflict with one another. In this war, more than in any other, in at least in American military history, the services were forced to work together in a sustained and intricate way. And the tensions that were overcome in the process of achieving that, I think, make for a very interesting study of the culture and the abilities of the American military in that era.
Because so much of what the U.S. and the Allies were focused on, of course, was Germany. Mm. So for a Cliff Notes version, basically this was a diversion, and that was often something that they had to contend with.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is one of the areas in which the literature has been a bit thin, but the Allies did agree to make Germany or Europe first the basis of their global strategy. That is to regard Nazi Germany as the prime enemy to be defeated first. And that strategic, in terms of its strategic logic, I think was unassailable. And virtually all American military leaders, even those fighting the Pacific War, agreed with that, with the single exception of Douglas MacArthur, who simply wanted more of everything. But it was a constant source of friction between the British and the Americans. The British really wanted to fight a defensive holding war in the Pacific and to concentrate all available resources for the early defeat of Germany. And so those arguments went on and unfolded, and I don't think they've been treated in the literature in the way with the depth and sophistication that they should. So that's another aspect of this story that I've taken an interest in.
Why do you think that is the case, especially since it was such an important part of the conflict?
I think studies of the high command have tended to really focus on the issues around the defeat of Nazi Germany and have treated the Pacific theater as very much of an afterthought. There are, I think I can say, really no studies of the decisions that were made by the Allied High Command, that is the American and British military leadership and Churchill and FDR and the circle of advisors around them. There hasn't been a convincing across-the-board account of the decisions that were made at that highest level with regard to the Pacific theater.
As you point out in the book, so there are several rounds of this where the first big war takes place in just the meetings amongst the Allies before you move to the next phase of actually doing something.
Mm, yes. Yeah, and the way that the Allies were able to manage these internal frictions, I think, is very interesting. It was a struggle between the British and the Americans. It was a struggle between the services in both countries. It was a struggle between theaters, between Europe and the Pacific. Within the Pacific, it was a struggle between the Army and the Navy and the two theater commanders, Douglas MacArthur, Chester Nimitz. So all of these frictions and tensions were constantly coming up throughout the entire war, affecting all of the major decisions And yet the Allies, partly because they had such significant advantages in the war inherently, but also because I think of there was a very high quality of leadership, were able to overcome those tensions.
Talk a little bit about the technology and what we had and the type of war that we ended up facing there to achieve the very goals you just mentioned.
Sure. Well, this is a period in which the technology of warfare had really advanced at an accelerating rate. Consider that the leaders of all of the combatant nations in the Second World War were in their late 50s, early 60s, say most of the general or flag officers. They had entered their profession right in the first years of the 20th century. So this was before the Wright brothers got off the ground, literally. It was right at the very beginning of radio. So radio had never been used previously to control ships at sea, for example. Submarines were primitive experimental vessels that usually posed more of a danger to their own crews than they did to the enemy. And in so many different areas, you had this extraordinarily rapid development of new technologies, aviation, communication, submarine technologies, to the point where by the late 1930s, in terms of naval warfare, the traditional adherence of the battleship, the big gun battleship, as being really the queen of naval power, were on the verge of being unseated by these advocates of aviation and submarines. So this was the war in which aircraft carriers first played a dominant role. It was the war in which submarines were able to essentially completely cut Japan's seaborne supply lines, which in itself was sufficient to destroy Japan's ability to wage war. So it was a period of extraordinary progress, and that presented real challenges to the leaders.
In those battles, the biggest challenge was geography, was the mileage, was how far one was from the other.
Absolutely, yeah. And the ability to project, to, for example, land forces on a hostile shore 1,000 miles or more away from your nearest base, that was something that was unprecedented in warfare. And it required, of course, an extraordinary mobilization of the American economy. Simply in 1942, the greatest constraint on the Allied war effort in all theaters appeared to be a lack of shipping. And so the ability to build many, many ships very, very quickly was critical. And by 1944 in the Pacific, there was so many ships of all classes coming into to service that the American forces were able to, in June 1944, the same month as the D-Day landings in Normandy, were able to leap across 1,000 miles of ocean and land 40,000 American troops on the island of Saipan, completely unprecedented military operation.
Ian Toll is our guest. The name of the book is The Conquering Tide, War in the Pacific Islands, 1942 to 1944. This is in the story where we learn what kind of enemy Japan is going to be, right? Of how they are going to fight this war and their rather ferocious attempt at not only fighting, but also making up for what they lacked.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. And I if what you're driving at are the atrocities,
yes,
really the atrocious behavior of Japanese forces, that is a it is a subject which I think has become a significant factor in the relationship between the different Asian nations, between China and Japan in particular, between Korea and Japan, the Philippines, and really now to a degree that I don't even think 20 years ago was true. These issues of wartime memory, of the Japanese people's memories or lack of memories of this war, have become an issue that really, in some senses, threatens the future of a peaceful Asia. And so they are very important also in this country. We've had a great deal of attention paid to this issue. Laura Hillebrand's Unbroken, I think, has probably been read by at least 10 million Americans, maybe more. So my view about it, and I'm somewhat partial to the Japanese because I lived there as a boy, and so I think of it as sort of a childhood home. My view is that something strange happened in Japanese history and culture in the 1930s, late 1920s, 1930s, which resulted in a culture of sort of a Japanese master race culture, a contempt for all other peoples that allowed these types of civilian atrocities, treatment of prisoners of war, to occur on a very wide scale. And that was a deviation from what had happened before. Very few people know, even people who are familiar with this history, know that just 35 years before the Second World War, in the Russo-Japanese War, Japanese forces had behaved with great discipline and had shown great chivalry toward their enemies. Russian prisoners had been treated very well. Their mortality rate had been less than 1%. Those who died had been buried with full military honors. The Japanese Red Cross had assisted civilians in the war zones in Korea and Manchuria. So there was a dramatic change which occurred in a short enough period of time that one man could have been a young officer in the First War and then still been in the service in the Second War. And why that happened is a question that I think scholars still need to struggle to answer. If you ask Japanese scholars, they will give you a range of answers.
Because there is that death before dishonor mantra that then gets extrapolated into what we saw here.
Yes.
Which is scattershot, and in many cases, just as you point out in the book, just overkill.
Absolutely. It was a fanatical kind of emperor-centered religious regime that had indoctrinated the soldiers and sailors of the Imperial Japanese forces. And when I was a boy living in Tokyo between the ages of 11 and 14, what we were told, and I remember we were told this in school, was that the Japanese of that period didn't believe in surrender. They believed that you had to die in combat rather than be captured. And therefore, anyone who did surrender, they believed had lost their honor, and therefore they could treat them however they liked. Now, of course, that's a completely unpersuasive and very flawed kind of answer to this question. But that's what we sort of told ourselves to smooth over these historical antagonisms. What I find to be interesting and somewhat concerning is that these antagonisms around the Second World War seem to be growing, if anything, in Asia at a time when the wartime generation is passing from the scene, which raises this question, is it going to become worse in the future? So one of the arguments I've made to Japanese leaders and scholars is better to, when addressing this issue of Japan's record in the Second World War with regard to civilians and prisoners, would be better to, in a sense, plead temporary insanity, to say there was a 15-year period, which the Japanese call their Dark Valley, between 1930 and 1945, period when the military essentially took over the country and launched all of these military adventures abroad, to say that 15-year period was a deviation in our history. And I think that there are a good historical argument can be made. And this is a country that is 2,600-odd years old. So no country ought to be judged entirely on what had occurred in such a short window of time. And I think that would be a better argument to use rather than what many, not all, but many Japanese, including the current government of Japan, seems to be determined to try to whitewash some of these issues and to try to remember the Japanese war in the way that, say, my Southern relatives used to remember the Civil War. It was a grand cause, but a lost cause. We fought with great courage, and we can remember what we tried to do, you know, with a certain amount of nostalgia.
So in other words, take a page from our playbook of Japanese internment camps and say this is a blight on our history and plead temporary insanity because of this. But I'm interested in your notion in is that good marketing or is that historically the truth?
Well, I think a good case. I mean, I've already mentioned how there was this cultural change that occurred in a very short period of time in the Japanese military. Japan had, over the long term, going back into its past, had been largely aloof from the rest of the world. But given that prior to this period, this Dark Valley period, Japan's conduct had been consistent with the values and the standards that the Western nations held themselves to, in some cases even better. And that given that since then, Japan is a country with a pacifist constitution, a place in which hatred for war is very widespread, inculcated among the Japanese people, widely shared, revulsion toward war. And it's a democratic country where people's personal freedoms are respected, law-abiding. Given all of that, I think, yes, there is a very strong historical argument to be made to say, something happened in our history for 15 years, and it doesn't reflect who we are. But of course, that requires acknowledging that right. You know these things happened, and that appears to be strongly it's a concept which is strongly resisted among important parts of Japanese society, and that includes the current government of Japan.
Ian Toll is our guest. The name of the book is The Conquering Tide, War in the Pacific Islands, 1942 to 1944. By the end of the book in 1944, Americans have dominated the Pacific. How were they able to ultimately do that?
Well, I could go on for an hour answering that question, so I'll try to narrow it down. But
you've written a lovely book all about just that, actually. But in a nutshell, what were they able to achieve? Because we've talked about many of the challenges
sure. Of
what they were able to overcome, right. And ultimately the key to that.
Yeah, well, I would narrow it down, I suppose, to two, broadly speaking, two areas. One, I think it's well understood by anyone who's familiar at all with the history of World War II that our economy managed to produce a war machine that was larger and in many ways better than that of any other nation. So it's just the massive production of ships and airplanes and weaponry in an industrial economy that was both very efficient and highly modernized, but was also, and this is important, completely beyond the reach of enemy bombers or armies. And so it was just the sheer amount of material that we had, I think, was important. Secondly, I do think that you have to credit the leadership of our American military services during that period. And there was, over this period between the Second World Wars, a long period in which military spending had declined very sharply through the Great Depression. And yet there was a core of officers who were able to maintain a certain intellectual capital that allowed for this rapid mobilization that occurred after 1940.
This, as we mentioned, is the second volume of the Pacific War trilogy. So how does this bring us into volume three and the job before you now?
Right. So volume three will deal with the last year of the war. And this is a really dark story. My title is Twilight of the Gods. And you had now a year in which it was clear even to the Japanese leaders that they had lost the war. And yet an all-out determination to fight until the very end. Nazi Germany, incidentally, had very much the same sort of attitude about this. And so it will deal with the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the actions at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, the bombing campaign against Japan, and then ultimately, of course, the decision to drop atomic bombs on two cities, and finally the surrender.
The name of the new book is The Conquering Tide, War in the Pacific Islands, 1942 to 1944. It is published by W.W. Norton. Ian Toll, a great pleasure to have you on the program this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Again, Ian Toll's new history is The Conquering Tide. It is published by Norton. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.